You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, and thank you for joining The American Revolution. This week, episode 308, The McDougal Court-Martial. Last week, we covered events in Philadelphia after Yorktown. While everyone was celebrating the victory, there was still a war to be fought. The army desperately needed food and supplies. With the public no longer in fear of a British attack, politicians were even less inclined to impose taxes necessary to support the army. Washington spent about 4 months in Philadelphia meeting and lobbying members of Congress to support the army. Many, I think including Washington, had hoped that Yorktown would have convinced the British to give up and go home. There were some indications in late 1781 that Washington expressed privately a hope that he would be back home by the spring of 1782. By February, however, word arrived from London that the king had addressed Parliament after receiving news of Yorktown. The king called on Parliament to continue the war and not allow the loss at Yorktown to be the reason to give up on North America. Now, that speech let Americans know that Britain would not simply walk away and that the fighting would likely continue. In March of 1782, Washington left Philadelphia, not home to Mount Vernon as he hoped, but rather to rejoin the army in New York. In New York City, General Henry Clinton became even more isolated after the British surrender at Yorktown. The British general was always paranoid about his reputation. General Cornwallis had sailed to New York in November after the surrender and then left for London in December. Clinton knew that Cornwallis would spend the next few months blaming Clinton for everything that happened. This was not just conjecture. Clinton had forwarded on letters from Cornwallis to London, which essentially blamed the loss at Yorktown on Cornwallis's obligation to follow Clinton's orders. Clinton had other problems, too. Earlier, Clinton had deployed Captain Thomas Baddeley to Charleston, South Carolina. There, the captain had fallen ill and died. Nothing terribly unusual about that. However, Captain Baddeley's wife, Mary Baddeley, was Clinton's mistress. Clinton and Mrs. Baddeley had met in Boston early in the war. Ironically, she came to the general's attention after her husband had been stripped of his rank, after he had refused to allow another officer to have sex with his wife. Clinton ended up employing her as a housekeeper. Supposedly nothing untoward happened at that time. Clinton left Boston and Mrs. Baddeley when he moved to New York. As it turned out, Baddeley ended up in New York as well, with her son and destitute. Clinton once again employed her as a housekeeper. The two grew close, although they deny having a sexual affair, until Mrs. Baddeley found her husband sleeping with another woman. At that point, she separated and began a relationship with Clinton. Although there's no way that Clinton knew sending Captain Baddeley to Charlestown would result in his death, rumors around New York painted a conspiracy to get the husband out of the way. Clinton also faced an attack on a financial front. There had been accusations for several years that the army under Clinton was wasting far too much money. Expenses under Clinton were far higher than under General Howe, even though Clinton had a smaller army. While these rumors had persisted for some time, the North administration did not investigate. They did not want to push a winning general into resigning over complaints about a few pounds. A financial scandal would also only feed the opposition. In 1781, Colonel Duncan Drummond, a former aide-de-camp of General Clinton, began a financial investigation into expenses. Now, Clinton had approved the investigation to look into problems. However, Colonel Drummond soon opened up a much larger investigation into corruption and waste in the army, and that revelation was going to reflect poorly on Clinton as commander-in-chief in America. Drummond's zeal in his investigations was at first an annoyance for Clinton, but opening a financial scandal on top of the military loss at Yorktown would be a 1-2 punch against the commander and would irreparably damage his reputation. Clinton had requested to resign several times over the course of the war and had been denied each time. He had no great passion to remain in command in America, but neither did he want to be tossed out as a failure. Clinton also had a growing feud with General James Robertson. The general was also the royal governor of New York. Clinton suspected that Robinson had pushed Drummond into taking this corruption investigation further as part of a larger effort to get Clinton recalled so that Robertson could become the new commander of the British Army in America himself. Robertson had also sent letters to General Geoffrey Amherst in London complaining about the corruption. Robertson told Amherst that he could run the army in America for about half of what it cost under General Clinton. Now, Clinton, at this point, was really considering resigning and returning to Britain. The main thing keeping him from doing so was that he would have to leave Robertson in command. Now, New York had another VIP during this period. While the fighting was still going on at Yorktown, Admiral Digby had arrived in New York from Britain with 3 ships of the line. With the admiral was a 16-year-old midshipman named William Henry. What made this junior naval officer's arrival so exciting was that he was the son of King George III. This was the first time a member of the royal family had ever come to America. William was the 3rd son of George III. With 2 older brothers, it was never thought that he would inherit the crown. At age 13, in 1778, he received a commission in the Navy. He'd been present at several battles, and by all accounts was a cheerful and friendly young man. The prince had instant celebrity status in New York. When he took a walk down Wall Street, the loyalists would turn out to get a glimpse of the young prince. Within a few days of his arrival, General Clinton held a banquet for Admiral Digby and the prince. Following the dinner, Digby sent William back to the ship for the night. Digby warned Clinton and the other officers that raising the profile of the prince would put him in danger. That advice came too late. The arrival of the prince had already caught the attention of Colonel Matthias Ogden. The New Jersey colonel was a highly experienced officer. He had been a part of colonial protests since the Stamp Act and had joined the army at its outset in 1775, participating in the Quebec campaign. There's a famous painting of the death of General Montgomery at Quebec, and it depicts the general dying in the arms of then-Major Ogden. Later promoted to colonel, Ogden had fought in the Philadelphia campaign, wintered in Valley Forge, and took part in the Sullivan campaign in New York. In 1779, he was court-martialed, but acquitted of all serious charges, being found guilty only of gaming, that is, playing cards or dice. He received a reprimand and continued in service. In 1780, he had been captured and taken to New York as a prisoner of war, where he remained for 6 months before being exchanged. Shortly after the prince's arrival in New York, Ogden became aware of the fact, through intelligence sources, that he had cultivated inside the city. He learned that the prince not only strolled through the city streets with little protection, he also often slept in town, along with Admiral Digby, in a lightly guarded house in the city. Ogden put together a plan where he and about 40 men would slip across the Hudson River at night in whaleboats. They would take the house where Digby and Prince William were sleeping and bring them back to American lines before the British could react. It was a daring and risky plan. George Washington reviewed Ogden's plan and approved it. Unfortunately for the Americans, British intelligence was on the ball. British Captain George Beckwith received intelligence that the Americans were planning some sort of kidnapping plot in New York. After being informed, General Clinton doubled his own guards around his house, as well as that of Admiral Digby. He put the army on alert for such a raid, and when word got back to the Americans that the British were on alert for the raid, they ended up calling off their plans. A short time later, Admiral Digby and Prince William sailed for the West Indies. There would not be another opportunity to launch the raid. Now, Washington always had other matters to occupy his attention. It was around this same time that a dispute between two of his top generals came to a head. General William Heath was among the first generals appointed by the Continental Congress in 1775. He had been a leading officer in Massachusetts during the Siege of Boston. You may recall that I talked about how Heath lived on Dorchester Heights and that he had asked General Putnam to take those heights. Heath also had a book that explained how to take the heights, but didn't want Putnam to read it because he didn't like to lend out his books. Heath received promotion to Major General in August of 1776, when Congress promoted all the original brigadiers who had not yet received promotion. Washington did not seem particularly impressed with Heath. In 1777, he gave Heath a chance to lead an attack on Fort Independence in New York, something I discussed in an earlier episode. The attack was a mess and seems to have affirmed Washington's view that Heath was not a competent military commander. For the rest of the war, Washington refused to give Heath any position of importance. Instead, the general held a string of administrative positions. Even so, based on his seniority, Heath rose to the top of the army. By 1781, only General Horatio Gates was senior to Heath. And at this time, Gates was on leave from the army following the debacle at Camden. So Heath was the top-ranking officer in the army after Washington himself. As I said, though, Washington kept Heath from many important positions. When Washington took his army to Yorktown, he left Heath behind. Washington took General Benjamin Lincoln with him as his second-in-command. Given Heath's rank, he had to do something. So Washington left him in command of the forces around New York, where there would be no expected actions. Another lackluster major general left behind during the Yorktown campaign was General Alexander McDougall. You may recall that McDougall was an active leader in the Sons of Liberty in New York City before the war. When the war broke out, he took a commission as a colonel. He was promoted to brigadier at the same time Heath was promoted to major general. A little over a year later, McDougall also became a major general. The promotion probably had more to do with McDougall being one of the more senior brigadiers by that time, and the decision by Congress that New York deserved to have a second major general in the army. Washington also did not seem particularly impressed with McDougall's leadership skills and never gave him much of anything to do. McDougall had spent most of the war in the New York Highlands, hanging out where there was very little action. McDougall had been elected to the Continental Congress in 1780. He was only there for about a month. McDougall insisted on collecting his pay as a major general, as well as his payment for service in Congress. He wore his uniform to congressional sessions, which seemed to annoy many delegates. They insisted on referring to him as Mr. McDougall rather than General McDougall, much to his annoyance. His fellow New York delegate, Alexander Hamilton, nominated McDougall to become the new Secretary of Marine, essentially the civilian head of the Navy. McDougall had worked as a merchant captain before the war. He wanted to serve in that capacity, but he did not want to give up his commission as a major general in the Army. Eventually, Congress voted that he could not maintain both. The final motion praised McDougall for wanting to continue to serve his country in the Army, but that if he really wanted to do that, he needed to resign as Secretary of Marine. McDougall eventually did just that and remained on active duty in the Continental Army in New York. As I mentioned last week, Congress never chose a replacement for Secretary of Marine, and Robert Morris took over those responsibilities himself in addition to serving as Secretary of the Treasury. When McDougall returned to the Army, Washington put him back into an administrative position. When the Army left for Yorktown, McDougall remained behind at West Point. Heath and McDougall never really got along. Part of this may have been a natural dislike that New Englanders and New Yorkers had for each other. It could also be part that Heath was from an old established New England family, while McDougall was a recent Scottish immigrant. Maybe it was just that both officers were prickly and rather insecure about their abilities. Whatever the cause, Heath and McDougall did not seem to like each other from almost the beginning of the war. Heath had been one of the few Continental leaders who recommended against the Continental Army abandoning New York City in 1776. If Heath's recommendation had held, the armies almost certainly would have been completely destroyed by the British in Manhattan. MacDougall was particularly critical of Heath's judgment in that decision. A relatively minor incident arose after Heath took command of the army in New York. MacDougall's wife had ordered something from a merchant in New York City. The item took forever to be delivered. Now, between the time MacDougall had purchased the item and the time it was delivered, Washington had issued an order cutting off the purchase of anything from British-occupied New York City. To avoid any problems, MacDougall asked Heath to approve that he could claim the items that he'd already purchased. Heath refused. He said that only Washington or Governor Clinton could give such approval. MacDougall went to Clinton, who gave approval, but Heath's prickly decision to refuse an accommodation greatly annoyed MacDougall. Heath began issuing orders regarding the distribution of supplies that MacDougall regarded as absurd and illegal. The officers and men under his command were being denied adequate food and supplies while surrounding units received whatever they needed. MacDougall wrote to Heath saying, quote, "Whatever orders you shall please to give, whether they are clearly or doubtfully in the line of service, shall be implicitly executed. But permit me at the same time to inform you that it is my determination for the future to disobey every unmilitary and absurd order which may be given by any of your executive officers and to put them in arrest." Heath took this as a direct challenge to his command. A short time later, MacDougall was sitting around a table drinking with some of his subordinate officers. The topic of the 1776 evacuation of New York came up. MacDougall called Heath a knave for his call to remain in the city. MacDougall claimed that Heath knew that remaining was militarily foolish, but argued for it anyway because he knew it would increase his political popularity back in New England. MacDougall went on to accuse Heath of bypassing him and illegally requisitioning supplies in such a way that was weakening the military defenses at West Point. Heath got word of MacDougall's diatribe and immediately drew up a list of 7 charges against the general. These included mismanagement of supplies and, quote, "tending to lessen the confidence in the commanding general." Heath put MacDougall under house arrest and transferred command of West Point to Brigadier General James Patterson. MacDougall wrote to General Washington protesting his arrest. Washington, at Philadelphia this time, wrote to both men. His response was more formal than what I'm about to say, but he was essentially saying, "Guys, you are supposed to be the 2 grown-ups I left in charge of the army. If you had a dispute, we could have solved it quietly amongst ourselves. Now, by bringing charges, you're airing the Army's dirty laundry in front of everyone. This is not helping you, the Army, or the cause. At this point, though, we have no choice but to go through the official process." Washington convened a court-martial against General MacDougall and ordered General Sterling to preside. MacDougall brought countercharges against Heath and also objected to Sterling and several other officers appointed to the court-martial as being biased against him. This and other objections led to several delays before the court finally began hearing the case in April of 1782. Further delays during the trial, caused by objections and demands for evidence, meant that the court did not complete its work until August. MacDougall's main argument against the charge that he brought disrespect on General Heath was that he only stated facts that everyone already knew about the general. He sought to show that, objectively, Heath was a knave, and that calling him that did not diminish him in any way more than his actions already had. In the end, the court acquitted MacDougall on 6 of the 7 charges. It found him guilty of denouncing his commanding officer and ordered Washington to issue a reprimand. Washington, compelled by the court to do so, issued a reprimand, but said he did so, quote, "with extreme reluctance." In those same orders, he wrote of MacDougall's, quote, "generally acknowledged merit," and he ordered him back to duty. MacDougall agreed to drop the countercharges against Heath. It seems he took to heart Washington's admonitions that these court charges were only hurting the army, and he just wanted to put the matter behind him. Unfortunately, another general did not feel the same way. Soon after the court-martial rendered its verdict, MacDougall received a letter from General Sterling complaining that McDougal had insulted him in his accusations to remove him as head of the court-martial. Sterling at least implied that he wanted a duel to protect his honor. McDougal refused to apologize, but also replied that he had said nothing in his objections to question Sterling's character, honor, or integrity. Sterling did not back down. He wrote again, saying that even if McDougal did not use explicit words, he had insinuated that Sterling's reputation was not, well, Sterling. An exasperated McDougal wrote back, quote, "The trial is now finished, and the sentence published. Does your lordship wish to have me tried again by a court-martial where you are to preside? If not, this is immaterial to you and to me, whether my exceptions to you were legal or illegal." Sterling did not appear to press the matter any further, but the exchange resulted in two more Continental Major Generals who were no longer on speaking terms. Without an enemy to distract them, the Continental Army seemed to be turning on itself. And next week, we're going to head over to England to see how officials there reacted to the news of the loss of Yorktown.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, thanks for joining the American Revolution Podcast After Show, part of the Airwave Media Network. Thanks to my Patreon supporters in the Alexander Hamilton Club, George Davis, Mike Hager, John Celentano, Michael Mulhern, and the Sons of the American Revolution. And you can check out the Sons podcast at fastfunhistory.com. Thanks to Robert Morris Circle supporters, Patrick LeBeau and Kurt Avard. And welcome to Mira Sahi, who joined as a standard bearer on Patreon last month. Like everyone who supports this show at the $10 level or higher, she will receive a magnet with a different flag from the American Revolution each month. Thanks also to Blair Greenwood for a one-time gift via PayPal. Well, in the after show, I'd like to tell what happened to some of the people after the Revolutionary War. Prince William Henry, as you might guess, has a particularly interesting story. He continued to serve in the Navy, but was never allowed into a combat position after the Revolution. Instead, he ended up being appointed Lord High Admiral. While in office, he did some interesting things, including commissioning the first naval steamship and abolishing the Cat of Nine Tails for most punishments. But after he took a fleet of ships without permission and sailed off with knowing no where they went, his brother forced him to resign. After threatening to run for Parliament in the House of Commons, his father gave him a dukedom. This avoided the embarrassment of having his son in the House of Commons, because holding a title of duke made him ineligible. Instead, though, he served in the more respectable House of Lords. Now, despite the odds, William Henry would end up taking the throne as King William IV at the age of 64, after both of his older brothers died without issue. His parents, George III and Queen Charlotte, had 15 children, all of whom were legitimate. But George III also had Parliament pass the Royal Marriages Act of 1772, which gave the king the right to veto the marriage choice of any member of the royal family. As a result, none of his children had any legitimate heirs. They all got into illegitimate, unrecognized marriages, or just took lovers on the side. The result was that the king had a couple of dozen illegitimate grandchildren, but no one who could succeed him as king. Now, the king's eldest son, who later became King George IV, married a Catholic woman in an unrecognized marriage. His father forced his son to ignore that marriage and marry his cousin. The prince complied and managed to knock out one daughter before he separated and returned to fathering other illegitimate children with various other women. Now, everyone figured that the one legitimate daughter, Princess Charlotte, would continue the line of succession. But when she had a stillborn child and then died shortly after the birth, everyone freaked out. By this time, most of the king's children were too old to reproduce. George IV reigned for only 10 years after the death of his father, and the second son had already died. So that meant the third son, William, who was the subject of our episode today, succeeded to the throne at age 71. During his short 7-year reign, Britain abolished slavery, although William had argued against the law abolishing slavery when he was in the House of Lords. His reign also saw some of the most sweeping political reforms in the history of Britain, but again, William had opposed those reforms. As far as succession, William had at least 10 illegitimate children, but none legitimate. And after Prince Charlotte's death, he did marry a German princess in hopes of creating an heir, but they never had any children. His younger brother also married a German princess around the same time, in desperate hopes of someone in the family could produce an heir. The younger brother managed to produce a legitimate heir, meaning that his young daughter, named Victoria, managed to continue the line after William's death. My book recommendation this week is American Revolutionary, a biography of General Alexander MacDougall by William MacDougall. Like most biographies, I think this one has a bias in favor of the subject, and it may be that the author is a descendant of General MacDougall. Even so, it's a generally accurate, well-researched book and a good read. It was first published in 1977, and the author passed away in 2021. MacDougall is one of the lesser-known generals from the Revolution. If you'd like to know more about him, get a copy of An American Revolutionary, a biography of General Alexander MacDougall. Also, as an aside, a few years ago, archive.org provided borrow-only access to a bunch of books that were still under copyright. Due to a lawsuit, they had to restrict that access so that you can only see the cover and the first few pages of the book, and the book then shows up in the category as borrow unavailable, which means you can't see most of the content of the book. I discovered, though, that if you do a word search on the book that says borrow unavailable, you can access the pages that are relevant to your search. And for me, this is a great way to do a quick lookup for a particular topic in a book, and I thought I'd pass along that tip for anyone else who might find it useful. My online recommendation is Continental Army General Orders for August 8th, 1782, available on founders.archive.gov. And this sounds like a boring title, but these orders contain the findings against General MacDougall by the court-martial and also the commander's reprimand. The site, founders.archive.gov, is a great source for primary materials of all sorts. We mostly think of it for correspondence, but it contains a great deal more written material from this era. These orders come from the papers of General Washington, which you used to have to buy as a multi-volume set for thousands of dollars. All of this is available now free online in a format that is really great for searching. I use this site all the time. My only wish is that they would expand it beyond the papers of the 7 founders that they've already made available. As always, I've included direct links to the document on my blog and website. My question this week asks, was George Washington watching tons of poverty and homelessness happening and doing nothing about it? Well, the standard of living in the 18th century was much lower than it is today. We have the Industrial Revolution to thank for that. Before that, the average unskilled laborer in England lived on an inflation-adjusted equivalent of about $2,500 per year. In the colonies, it was a little better, at about $4,000 per year. People often worked 10 or 12-hour days, 6 days a week, in order to feed their families and live in homes that would be considered unfit for human habitation by today's standards. Now, there was no public welfare system. Some cities had workhouses where the poor could receive some food and shelter in exchange for work. Since public schools were not yet a thing, some organizations were formed to help poor children receive some level of education. Now, we know that Washington did have a fair amount of wealth, but most of that wealth was tied up in land. He did not always have enough cash, even to pay his own debts promptly. Even so, he regularly gave to local churches and other causes for purposes designed to help the poor. He even sponsored the college costs for several children of neighbors who were not as well off as he was. Like many landowners, Washington would offer food to those who came to his home in need, often in exchange for work. When he left for the Continental Army, he left these instructions to the person who was managing his estates. Quote, "Let the hospitality of the house with respect to the poor be kept up." He wrote, quote, "Let no one go hungry away. If any of these kind of people should be in want of corn, supply their necessities, provided it does not encourage them in idleness, and I have no objection to your giving my money in charity to the amount of 40 or 50 pounds a year, when you think it well bestowed." And what I mean by having no objection is that it is my desire that it should be done. After Washington became president, he received a rather generous annual salary. He gave away large amounts of that income to various causes, usually anonymously. He also donated extra food from the executive mansion to the local prison, where prisoners were notoriously underfed. He also sometimes paid off debts for men who were being held in debtor's prison. Now, could he have done more? Well, perhaps yes. But the common view at the time was being overly generous to the poor would be encouraging idleness, something the pre-industrial society could ill afford. Within the context of the times, Washington was probably more generous than most. If you have a question you'd like me to answer, please reach out to me either via email or on Twitter, Facebook, Quora, or Reddit. Well, that's all for this week. I hope you will join me again next week for another American Revolution podcast.
History isn't black and white, yet too often it's presented as such. Grey History, The French Revolution is a long-form history podcast dedicated to exploring the ambiguities and nuances of the past. From a revolution of hope and liberty to the infamous Reign of Terror, you can't understand the modern world without understanding the French Revolution. So search for The French Revolution today.